From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Cities have always inspired artists. Take New York. It's famous for its writers. John Cheever, Isaac Bashevis Singer, and now Colson Whitehead.
Pick a busy intersection and proclaim it your masterpiece. Like the best art, it was right in front of you all along, but now you see it for the first time. Like the best art, it will outlast you.
Garrison Keillor is another writer who loves New York, but he may love St. Paul even more.
One is grateful living in St. Paul, Minnesota, to be able to walk down the street and not become an extra in somebody else's movie, as so often happens in New York.
Today, the city as muse, and why certain cities are defined by their art, from the music of Memphis to the movies of Hitchcock's San Francisco.
Certain dramatic locations in the Bay Area just inevitably will evoke a Hitchcock image. I mean, you can think of Madeline jumping off the edge at Fort Point into the ocean, you know, with the dramatic view of the Golden Gate Bridge in Marin County. I mean, Hitchcock almost has taken sort of ownership or possession of an image like that.
But first, we go to New York.
I've a cozy little flat in what is known as Old Manhattan. We'll settle down right here in town. We'll have Manhattan, the Bronx and Staten Island too. It's lovely going through the zoo.
Maybe we become New Yorkers when we realize that New York will go on without us. To put off the inevitable, we try to fix the city in place. Remember it as it was, doing to the city what we would never allow to be done to ourselves.
Colson Whitehead, reading from his book The Colossus of New York, his literary portrait of New York City.
The kid on the uptown one train, the new arrival stepping out of Grand Central, the jerk at the intersection who doesn't know east from west. Those people don't exist anymore, ceased to be a couple of apartments ago, and we wouldn't have it any other way. New York City does not hold our former selves against us. Perhaps we can extend the same courtesy. What follows is my city, making this a guidebook with handy color-coded maps and minuscule fine print you should read very closely so you won't be surprised. It contains your neighborhoods, or doesn't. We overlap, or don't. Maybe you've walked these avenues, maybe it's all Jersey to you. I'm not sure what to say. Except that probably we're neighbors, that we walk past each other every day and never knew it until now.
Do you think of yourself as a quintessential New Yorker?
By default, I mean, I don't really fit in anywhere else. And I think, you know, from growing up there, you're hardwired in a certain way. You walk fast, talk fast, you have places to go. You know, I've tried to live other places, but it doesn't really work out all the time, so.
But it's funny, reading the first essay in your book, you're essentially saying anybody who walks on a street in New York is in some ways a New Yorker the moment you walk there, because everybody who's been there is only there for a little while.
Yeah, I mean, I think it claims you as soon as you step off the bus or get off the train and accepts you. And I think that's, you know, part of what I'm trying to get at. I think it's a very welcoming place, and it has very big arms.
Yeah. You've been all over. This book goes all over in the city of New York. You've chosen some things. I mean, you start with the Port Authority, I suppose, because the Port Authority is where half the people who come there get their first taste of the city. What do you see when you get to the Port Authority?
Home. I love getting there because the architecture, it was renovated in the 70s and it's really ugly. And that's the sort of 70s New York I grew up in. It's very garish. They haven't fixed it up in a long time. So, you know, my main idea of a bus station is the Port Authority.
There's another section of the book that I really like. It's on Broadway. Part of the reason I think of that is because everybody has seen an aerial photo of Manhattan. There are all these grids, these streets that go at right angles to each other. And then there's that big slash. Yeah, cuts right across the city.
You can't stop Broadway. And I think its best part is when it hits 23rd Street and there's a Flatiron building. And it's like a building that actually couldn't exist because Broadway took up all its space. So it's just like a slim triangle, you know, on the avenue. Yeah, I mean, that chapter is very personal. You know, on the first warm day, I always have to go to Broadway and see what's changed and see what's still there.
This chapter is a long walk, basically. You go from one end of Broadway to the other. It feels like that anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I've lived uptown and downtown, so I have different ideas of Broadway from different times in my life. So I don't name streets. I don't name, you know, intersections. And so I think each person can sort of superimpose their own Broadway upon this, you know, person's walk. Walk until your heart grows heavy with freight. He has fraught corners. Some places he passes give him the creeps. Their first date in this restaurant, their last date in that restaurant. His ex used to live upstairs. They made out on that stoop and passers-by heckled his technique. He had to make that call, it was very important. And the public phones on the street were cursed, did not work, devoured quarters, and it was disastrous. He has fraught corners, and you have yours. Avoid them because you don't want to be reminded. Pavement that remembers a night best forgotten. Potholes that remind you of sunken places in your spirit. See it this day and proclaim, this block's got nothing on me. To be free of all that came before, to mold your face to the cliche of this place. Pick yourself, be famous and celebrated, be a modern artist. Pick a busy intersection and proclaim it your masterpiece. The critics love it, applaud your sense of color, wonder how you got the faces like that. An undercurrent of metropolitan alienation, says one. Like the best art, it was right in front of you all along, but now you see it for the first time. Like the best art, it will outlast you.
One of the recurring themes in this is that for every New Yorker, every walk involves a city they knew, underimposed,
right? Yeah,
on the city they see.
Yeah, and I think it's the same with all places. You kind of, when a Starbucks comes in, you still remember the shoe store that was there, or the diner where you had, you know, your first date with somebody. So the city, your hometown, becomes a, you know, palimpsest that you're always kind of superimposing your memories and your expectations.
So when you look at that Starbucks, you see shoes on the shelves in the back.
Yeah, but I mean, I also appreciate Starbucks. I know it's a gauche to say, but I think that the nation, the city is always changing, and that, you know, the big chain stores that are taking over Times Square are kind of garish and ugly, and they've replaced the kind of delicately seedy, you know, Times Square of old. But you can't hold the city back. You can't hold progress back, and you have to adapt to it, or else, I mean, you're out.
There's another chapter in your book on the rush hour, which has some of the same kind of flavor to it. You found the energy of people who are riding. I was in London several years ago with my brother-in-law. We decided one morning to get up and just hop on the underground because we wanted to see how people got to work in the morning. I was a tourist then. In some ways, you're a tourist in writing that chapter, but it's clear that this is a place where you're very much at home. I mean, riding in the rush hour is normal life.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess I'm lucky now that I work at home and I can miss morning rush hour and late rush hour. And when I am actually forced into the subway at 6 o'clock, I'm really horrified. Like I'm totally you know, maladapted to do it now because I'm not in shape. And so my wife goes to work and she says, like, you don't know what it's like out there. It's terrible. I'm like, it's just a subway. And then I go, it's like, she's actually really right. This is terrible. And I'm really getting off easy.
There's a sense for those of us who don't live in New York City that there are just too many people there. That's clearly not the case for you. It's enough people.
Perhaps a little too many, but I'm in Brooklyn now and it's very neighborhoody and very peaceful. So I go to Manhattan maybe twice a week. And I definitely feel like I am going into a different city from Brooklyn, and I am wearing a certain kind of armor. But New York is like that. And, you know, in a subway car, we're all crammed together, rich man, poor man, black, white, people on the way up, people on the way down. And for a minute, we're sort of distracted by the baby in the carriage, and we're all sort of cooing over the baby. And then it's gone. But for an instant, we're all sort of in this kind of maternal moment, all strangers, but united for an instant. And it's that kind of accidental grace I'm trying to get at in the book.
You end your book with a short chapter on JFK, the airport a lot of people use to leave New York. I get the sense you really like going to JFK.
Yeah, and also, I mean, I love buildings. I'm not well versed in the language of architecture, but JFK is just a beautiful, beautiful airport. And I really get a real kind of rush. It's time to go. Everything's packed. All the necessary documentation is secure in pockets and pouches. The time passed so quickly. Take a moment to look back and regret all the things you didn't get to do, the places you didn't get to visit, what you did not see. Promise yourself, maybe next time. Assuming it will still be here when you finally return. Sometimes things disappear. The airport is one of many conveniently located exits. In the beautiful terminals, you can go to anywhere in the world. The names of carriers sort them by destination. Shuffle along and do as you're told. Just a matter of time before you're home. Take your seat. When you talk about this trip, and you will, because it was quite a journey and you witnessed many things. There were ups and downs, sudden reversals of fortune, and last-minute escapes. It was really something. You will see your friends nod in recognition. They will say, "That reminds me of," and they will say, "I know exactly what you mean." Talking about New York is a way of talking about the world.
Colson Whitehead's book is called The Colossus of New York, a city in 13 parts. Public Radio's Garrison Keillor knows as much as anyone about what it means to be a New York writer. In faraway Minnesota, he grew up idolizing The New Yorker, and then he started to write for the magazine. For a time, he lived in the Big Apple, but family and his radio show pulled him back to St. Paul, Minnesota, so maybe it's not surprising that his latest novel, called Love Me, explores the tension between New York and St. Paul, between urban sophistication in the Midwest. Steve Paulson talked with Garrison Keillor about what it means to write and live in these two very different cities.
At the beginning of your novel, your character, Larry Wyler, is consumed by envy when another St. Paul writer has a hit novel, and Larry immediately sets out to write the great Midwestern novel, which of course fails. And I love that idea of the great Midwestern novel. I guess I was wondering, is there such a thing?
I guess that Giants in the Earth probably was the great novel, and it is inflicted on junior high school students, I believe. Reading Giants in the Earth, I think, can probably save you from ever trying to write a novel yourself. Giants in the Earth, assigned to junior high school kids, preserves this country from more authors than we have now.
I confess, I've never read Giants in the Earth. What's it about?
Well, there you are. It's about Norwegian immigrants and their sufferings in South Dakota. It's also the reason that South Dakota is not a more heavily populated state.
It almost goes against the grain, though, doesn't it? It seems so un-Midwestern to aspire to write the great Midwestern novel.
Yes, but it's a secret aspiration. And one carries it around in one's heart. It's the aspiration of people who, when they were teenagers, were odd and quiet and geeky and skinny and wore the wrong kind of glasses and wore clothes that were hand-me-downs from their older brother, were odd in all sorts of other ways. And they carried around this secret dream.
Do you have to get away from home? Do you have to move to New York City to make it big?
No, you just need to have a good imagination and carry this around in your heart.
Now, eventually, Larry Wyler chucks his great Midwestern novel. He realizes it's dull, dull, dull. And he ends up writing a much racier and a more violent novel, which does become a bestseller. And it means that Larry won't just be a local writer, which is the thing that he dreads more than anything else. And I'm wondering how much of this was your story when you were first starting out as a writer that you felt like you had to go to New York.
Oh, it's everybody's story, I think, who is from the Midwest and who has a dream of becoming a writer. The Midwest is a literary hotbed. It is a hotbed of readers. New York is a center of the publishing industry, but when you scratch New Yorkers, you don't find too many ambitious readers. You find people who kind of know a little bit about which books are hot right now. But you go to the Midwest and you find people who are keeping up with fiction at the same time as they are going back to Thackeray and rereading Dickens, going through a cycle of Dickens novels. You find passionate people who spend hours a day reading fiction.
And yet, certainly just in terms of the population of where writers hang out, there are an awful lot of them who live in New York.
There are, and it feels crowded. When you go to New York and you're a writer, you are always on some other writer's turf. If you are on the Upper West Side, you keep bumping into something that Isaac Bashevis Singer wrote years ago that's better than anything you could write. You come into Midtown and you bump into John O'Hara and Holden Caulfield and Catcher in the Rye are up there on the West Side and Midtown, and E.B. White is around and John Cheever is around and Edith Wharton, God bless her, is still around. You keep bumping into these. But in the Midwest, you kind of feel as if you own some of this terrain yourself.
Now, once Larry Wyler does hit it big with his bestseller, St. Paul starts to look very drab and small, and he heads off to live in the big city in New York, and he's always dreamed of working at the New Yorker, and he gets a gig there. He leaves his wife back in St. Paul. And there's a passage where he reflects on what he's come to see as the smallness of his old life in St. Paul. And I'm wondering if you could read that.
Larry is thinking to himself here. He says, life presents us with certain gifts. The fog lifts. The coast is clear. Time to be venturesome. You spent 15 years in the potato fields. Try the jazz life for a while. Some odd experience is available now that might not be later. Adventure. It saves us from smugness, the sin of the Midwest. That extra top spin you put on the truth when you know they know you're right. The vanity of the modest, their reflexive remorsefulness, their humorlessness. A little glorious stupidity can be a tonic. We are good people and we are mean sons of bitches. We're fractious, susceptible to envy, suspicious, cruel. We did not fall to earth from a distant galaxy. We arrived via mortal beings with splendid faults, many of which we inherited. Mine is restlessness. I hate boredom. It terrifies me. Goodbye, Minnesota.
Now, in some ways, the story of this book is Larry comes to repudiate those sentiments that you just read, and yet my sense is that you find a lot of truth in what he's saying right there as well.
He doesn't repudiate them. He doesn't regret having gone off to New York and had an adventure and gotten out of the Midwest. He needs to stay in the game, and he needs to stay with his good luck. And he couldn't do that if he stayed in the Midwest. He also wants to get out of the Midwest because in the Midwest, it's not possible, he thinks, to really celebrate your success and be happy with it. You always have to be self-deprecating, and it's not possible to write a large act for yourself, especially in the company of his friends who are wary lest he get a big head.
Now, I suppose the other side of arrogance is niceness, which in many ways is, of course, a wonderful thing. My experience is it's also something that a lot of East Coast folks have a hard time with when they move to the Midwest. I mean, people here just seem too nice to them. Do nice people sometimes get on your nerves?
Well, I wouldn't characterize niceness as being the opposite of arrogance. I think the opposite of arrogance is self-knowledge. And I think self-knowledge can only lead to humility, but it does not necessarily make one meek or soft-spoken. These are personality choices that one makes. And niceness, I guess I think of as a kind of superficial set of manners which makes some things easier and makes other things much more difficult. If you have a gang of small-town Midwesterners who are determined to be nice in the sense of never expressing personal preference, even if you hold a gun to their heads, you're going to have a very difficult time planning a trip. This is going to drive you nuts.
Well, at a more mundane level, it seems that sort of the curse of niceness may be that people are just too constrained to say what they're really feeling. I mean, you could know someone, know a neighbor for years, but never really say what you mean. Do you find that to be true?
Oh, yes, of course. It's true all of the time. And there are times when one is grateful for it. One is grateful living in St. Paul, Minnesota, to be able to walk down the street and be passed by all sorts of people who choose not to let you in on their life, choose not to act out their troubles, choose not to yell at mailboxes. One is grateful for this, and it gives you a sort of privacy. You can walk around in the company of other people in St. Paul, Minnesota, and think your own thoughts and not become an extra in somebody else's movie, as so often happens in New York.
Can you ever see yourself moving back to New York?
Oh, I could in a minute. It would be lovely. But I have a 5.5-year-old daughter, and I made a decision in her behalf that she should be brought up in the company of relatives, and she should enjoy the lucky fact that she has cousins and aunts and uncles galore, and she should bask in their affection. I did, and I would want her to be able to as well. And they're not in New York. They're in Minnesota.
Garrison Keillor talking with Steve Paulson. Garrison's latest novel is called Love Me.
Now, if you live life in the middle and not on the edge, you're hopelessly Midwestern. And if a big Saturday means clipping the hedge, you're hopelessly Midwestern. If you shop at Sears, drink a lot of iced tea, you like to dance the polka and watch TV, then the jury is in and the critics agree, you're hopelessly Midwestern.
Coming up, a city that's anything but Midwestern. San Francisco, as seen through the eyes of Alfred Hitchcock. Also, the music of Memphis. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Our theme this hour is the city as muse, how certain cities have inspired their artists. Now, you might be surprised to hear that Alfred Hitchcock, that proper British gentleman, made several movies in and around San Francisco. Shadow of a Doubt, The Birds, and most famously, Vertigo, which used the city's tall buildings and high vistas to play up Jimmy Stewart's fear of heights. Hitchcock loved San Francisco. In fact, he had a home nearby for over 30 years, and his San Francisco films show an intimate knowledge of the city. Writers Jeff Kraft and Aaron Leventhal live in the Bay Area, and they're both avid Hitchcock fans. They've now put together a book called Footsteps in the Fog, Alfred Hitchcock's San Francisco. They told Ann Strainchamps it's a kind of walking tour of the filmmaker's city. Aaron Leventhal.
We're obsessed, to put it very simply. We watched this film so many times that I find it difficult actually to go back and watch Vertigo. But in essence, what we did is we walked in Hitchcock's footsteps by watching the films that he did, researching the permits he filed, the notes that he took, even the production schedules that he followed, in order to better identify the actual locations that we saw on film.
Jeff, in Vertigo, wouldn't you say that he really kind of makes the city a character in the film? I mean, describe that opening shot, for instance. It's very famous.
Sure, yeah, the opening shot, it lets the audience immediately know that the film is taking place in San Francisco. And what you have is a rooftop chase sequence where a criminal is being chased by the main character, Scotty Ferguson, and a police officer across the rooftops of sort of Lower Knob Hill in San Francisco. And you have this sort of dramatic panoramic arc of San Francisco, which you can see almost all of the famous San Francisco landmarks in downtown. You can see the Southern Pacific Railroad building, the Bay Bridge, the skyscrapers on Montgomery Street, which were the tallest buildings west of Chicago. And you just know immediately that you're in San Francisco. You see Coit Tower, and you immediately have this sense of the bay, of the panoramic views, and sort of the drama of the city.
And then it's his acrophobia that leads him to become kind of the mark or the victim in this complex murder plot. There's a scene at the beginning of the movie that I really love where the two guys, Jimmy Stewart, Scotty, has gone to visit Gavin Elster, this old college friend who's moved to San Francisco. And it begins with it's just these two guys talking about the city. And then it segues into this moment when Jimmy Stewart is kind of first drawn into the murder plot. Well, actually, we've got that clip, so we should just go ahead and play that.
My wife's family is all gone. Someone has to look after her interests. So I decided, as long as I had to work at it, I'd come back here.
You like it, huh?
Well, San Francisco's changed. The things that spell San Francisco to me are disappearing fast. Color, excitement, power, freedom.
What's in your mind, Gavin?
Scotty, do you believe that someone out of the past, someone dead, can enter and take possession of a living being?
No.
If I told you that I believe this has happened to my wife, what would you say?
Well, I'd say take her to the nearest psychiatrist. I'd have him check on you, too.
You know what I love, too, about that scene is that it just goes to the meticulous nature that Hitchcock uses to approach his films. Throughout Vertigo, he had people go to Ranzahoff's, which is a very high-end shopping center, or to have the women go to Elizabeth Arden's to get their hair done, have women wear white gloves. Everything just oozed the time of 1957-58 San Francisco.
Well, and he used a lot of real locations in the movie The Flower Shop, for instance, in which you first see Madeline go and get this little bouquet that matches the bouquet of a painting that she goes to see. That flower shop was a real place, right?
It was a real place. It was called Podesta Baldacci, and it existed on Grant Street near Union Square. And in fact, the story about filming in the flower shop goes that Hitchcock was so meticulous about exactly the way he wanted the scene to look that they had to replace all the flowers in the flower shop several times because the lamps that were required for filmmaking were so hot they wilted all the flowers. And he wanted to get the exact right pattern of traffic passing through the window and things like that. You know, so he did so many long takes in the shop.
But why do things like that? Surely it would have been easier for him just to construct a set with a flower shop.
Hitchcock actually became very well known before Vertigo, shooting in 1943 in Santa Rosa, Shadow of a Doubt, for being a director who was willing to take chances and doing things differently than other directors. And one of the main things that he was known for in that film was going during wartime, 1943, directly into a town and basing his whole film on the streets and the life of that city. And that was very unusual at that time.
You're talking about the movie Shadow of a Doubt.
Shadow of a Doubt, 1943, with Joseph Cotten and Teresa Wright. And in many ways, it's a time capsule for the way Santa Rosa looked in 1943. You see military people just walking the streets right through the scene. You see, you know, the small town library.
Why was that so important to Hitchcock, do you think? I mean, it just he had this kind of documentary sensibility to him?
He was very into his films having a dramatic, powerful psychological impact on his audience. And I think part of his philosophy was that very, very authentic details gave his films a richness and a believability that actually helped, of course, promote and enhance the suspense that he was driving for.
Well, Shadow of a Doubt is one of the other, which you could think of as Hitchcock's three kind of signature Bay Area films. And in this one, he's created Santa Rosa as the small town that he sets up in contrast to the wicked big city, which is where Uncle Charlie comes from. But just run through the plot a little bit, would you, just to remind us what that movie's about?
Sure. In Shadow of a Doubt, Uncle Charlie, who is the merry widow murderer who has relationships with rich older widows and then kills them, is on the East Coast, in the sort of decrepit, decaying East Coast, and he needs to escape town because things have gotten a little bit too hot for him. So he wires his family out in the all-American, lovely small town of Santa Rosa, California. And Uncle Charlie comes to town and meets sort of his twin or his double, which is Young Charlie, the nickname of the oldest daughter in the Newton household in Santa Rosa. And eventually, Young Charlie becomes suspicious of Uncle Charlie, that he really is the merry widow murderer, and he tries to kill her.
You know, the signature of so many of his movies is he'll take a perfectly ordinary setting, and then he'll gradually add this note of menace and foreboding. He does that just so beautifully. For instance, there's one of my favorite scenes in Shadow of a Doubt is, you know, that one when Uncle Charlie is at the family dinner table, and his sister tells him that he's been asked to give a little lecture at the local women's institute or something. And, well, here's how the rest of the scene goes.
What sort of an audience would it be?
Oh, women like myself, busy with our homes, most of us.
Women keep busy in towns like this. The cities, it's different. The cities are full of women, middle-aged widows, husbands dead.
Husbands who've spent their lives making fortunes, working and working. And then they die and leave their money to their wives, their silly wives. And what do the wives do, these useless women? You see them in the hotels, the best hotels, every day by the thousands, drinking the money, eating the money, losing the money at bridge, playing all day and all night, smelling of money, proud of their jewelry, but of nothing else. Faded, fat, greedy women.
But they're alive, they're human beings.
Are they?
That's such a great scene and so eerie and so contrasts, you know, the big city evil Uncle Charlie with the good, virtuous small town people.
And, sure. And the viciousness and hatred that he speaks with is just really shocking and chilling.
Yeah. The other signature Bay Area film, of course, is The Birds, which was set in another small town around the Bay Area. How did that movie come about?
Well, The Birds was based on a Daphne du Maurier novel set in the English countryside. And Hitchcock liked the story, thought it would be an amazing technical challenge to try and create the special effects of The Birds, but he wanted a more contemporary, more updated setting. And he actually thought that Northern California in many ways reminded him of England. The weather was somewhat similar in the dramatic coastal areas. And so in his mind, he thought it would be exciting to set the film in a somewhat isolated area in Northern California, but that was still close enough to the major metropolitan area of San Francisco for a short weekend trip.
And it was a wonderful start to the film. It's Tippi Hedren walking across Union Square. A cable car goes by. In order to really give you a sense, just in those first, you know, 30 seconds of the film, the feeling for San Francisco and how kind of stylish it is, and how even sunny and bright it is, even though as she looks up, she hears kind of birds circling over Union Square, just a hint of menace, but nevertheless, otherwise, it's very kind of happy and cheery as she goes into the pet shop. Which is a great contrast to her then driving up the coast. And Hitchcock decisively added the driving scene so you could get a sense of separation from the big city so that you would feel when the birds actually do attack that you are at your own devices. You have to use your own resources. You can't just escape back to the big city. It's too far.
There was an actual case of birds attacking residents or birds infiltrating a small town along the coastal area, wasn't there?
Yeah, it's interesting. After Hitchcock had decided he wanted to make The Birds, and he knew he wanted to set it in Bodega Bay in Northern California, Hitchcock heard about a bird incident that occurred just south of his weekend home near Santa Cruz, where thousands of birds, people think they either got lost in the fog or they ate toxic anchovy fish, and they swarmed into Capitola, smashing into streetlights, breaking windows, crashing into cars, and just leaving a total mess. And so Hitchcock heard about this, and then he actually wove the actual descriptions of the bird incident in Santa Cruz into some dialogue that occurred at the Tides restaurant in the movie The Birds.
I hardly think a few birds are going to bring about the end of the world. These weren't a few birds.
Really, let's be logical about this.
What were the crows after at the school?
What do you think they were after, Miss...
Daniels. I think they were after the children.
For what purpose?
To kill them.
Why?
I don't know why.
I thought not.
Say, something like this happened in Santa Cruz last year. The town was just covered with seagulls.
That's right, sir. I recall it. A large flock of seagulls got lost in the fog and headed into the town where all the lights were.
And they made some mess, too, smashing into buildings and everything.
Of course, this was all in the days before big-time special effects. How did he actually get the effect of all those birds attacking people?
Well, in many ways, Hitchcock was an innovator of, quote, special effects that we now think of in you know, modern films. It's very common, computer-generated special effects. Even now, you can still see that he did meticulous work adding real birds wherever possible, but matting them in or drawing them in when he needed. He actually used robotic birds. He used all different techniques to try to get the 10,000-plus birds onto the scene at any one time.
But in some scenes, they were real birds. I mean, for instance, what about the most gruesome scene when Tippi Hedren is attacked in the house upstairs at night?
Sure. And in that case, there were real birds. There were also stuffed birds. I think there's a stuffed bird on her shoulder that you can see one time. But in that scene, he did use real birds, and he actually didn't tell Tippi Hedren that he was going to use real birds until she actually came onto the scene. So she was a little out of sorts filming that scene, which obviously is revealed on film. And what they did is they, in some cases, tied the birds to her so that they couldn't get very far. So, in fact, she was struggling with real birds at that time and did actually sustain a fairly severe gash on her face from that experience.
That sounds pretty nightmarish.
Yeah, it does.
Aaron Leventhal and Jeff Kraft talk with Ann Strangechamps. Their book is called Footsteps in the Fog, Alfred Hitchcock's San Francisco. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about how certain cities have inspired artists. Memphis is famous for its music. You might call it the birthplace of the blues, rock and roll, and soul. One man in the 50s who helped disseminate this music was a DJ named Dewey Phillips.
Yes, sir, let's all stay tuned for the hottest thing in the country, Pop Chart, coming to you through WHBQ-TV and WHBQ-Radio. They don't make no show, and none better, bar none. Am I right, Dizzy?
That's right. Tell him about it. I'm with you, partner. I'm with you, partner. I'm with you, dears. You better believe it.
Music writer Robert Gordon writes about Dewey Phillips and the history of Memphis music in a book called It Came from Memphis. It's a very personal take on the culture that shaped Gordon himself. He told Steve Paulson that he's always been drawn to music that's slipping under the radar of mainstream culture.
It's very easy to visit Memphis and never find your way into this original world, the sort of world that grew from the people in the Delta coming to the city and this mix of country and city and rich and poor and black and white. And that's what I like. I like that exchange that happens in small, dark places.
Are you talking about clubs in particular or just all over?
Just kind of generally all over. I first kind of started on this course in 1975 or 6 or 7, the Rolling Stones played a huge outdoor stadium in Memphis on the 4th of July, hot as could be. and they were supposed to go on at, you know, 6 p.m. Well, they didn't know that, you know, at 6 p.m. it was, you know, going to be 105 degrees out, and so they didn't want to play. They wanted to wait till after dark, not knowing that after dark it would only be 103. So while these 55,000 people waited in the heat, they sent a car and they brought Furry Lewis, this bottleneck blues player, to come kind of fill the gap. And I remember being in the field and hearing this sound and turning around, and I was a teenager, young teenager, and I realized that this music I'd been sort of aware of on record was actually alive, and not only alive, but alive in my town. And about a year later at my high school, someone went and picked up Furry Lewis and brought him out, and he played on the porch at lunchtime, and we passed a hat. And so I found out who the upperclassman was who brought him. I said, "How'd you do that?" And he gave me a phone number. And I went to the school phone and called Furry Lewis. And that afternoon, I wasn't old enough to drive yet. I got a ride over to Furry's house. And that was sort of my entrance into this world below the radar, as it were.
Now, that's sort of an amazing story. I mean, here you were going to a suburban school, right?
Right
outside of Memphis, you know, white kid. And then somehow hooking up with this old blues guy. I mean, you might think that there would be a big cultural divide there.
Well, Furry was a gracious host. What I became aware of was that Furry and other old black blues artists had been exchanging culture with younger white artist hippie types. So when I showed up as a kid, I was sort of just another one of those guys.
And I'm going to Brown, Vermont, take that right-hand road.
You've written that Furry Lewis could express the world with a single note.
And what that is about the note and the space before and after the note.
Lord, I ain't gonna stop walking till I get my baby's door.
Furry could let a note hang and hang, and you'd be waiting, and then when it would happen, it was just, you know, pure joy.
And that woman I love ain't got great long curly hair. And that woman got great long curly hair. But a mother and father do not lie me there.
So what was it like for you as a kid, a high school kid, to go out and go to Furry Lewis's house?
Well, it was, you know, the mid-70s, and eventually, you know, I turned 16, I got a driver's license. At that time, there weren't photo IDs, so I had a fake ID. I could buy whiskey at the store and bring it to Furry's house.
What did you do? Did you just sort of hang out and talk, or did he play?
I'd show up. He lived in a duplex, and you walked into his bedroom, and then there was a little, like, alcove and then a kitchen, very small. Furry would be sitting up on the bed. He had a wooden leg at the knee. It would be off a lot of times, and ladies were there. Furry had the ladies. He was, you know, in his 70s at the time, and he had lady friends. And I learned, you know, to call in advance and tell him I was coming, ask him if I could bring anything besides whiskey, just that was kind of like the barter to get in the door. And then often he would ask for an uncooked hamburger from Wendy's. So we'd always say, cook it a little bit, cook it a little bit. And then—
Why did he want an uncooked hamburger from Wendy's?
The way he liked them, I guess. I don't know. Then to get him to play, you'd have to give him some money. I didn't get it at the time. You know, I was trying, and so Furry would let me stay, but Furry was there and some ladies were sitting around, and I had brought a couple guys I'd met on the street from France who were touring, and we started talking about, well, you know, can you play? Yeah, I can play. Let's get a bottle of whiskey, Furry said. And, you know, we pulled up enough money for a half pint. And Furry, you know, had the guitar out and he played a little bit and said, you know what, I got the rheumatism today. I don't feel like playing. And, you know, looking back, I realized, oh, dummy, you know,
You didn't quite bring enough money there.
Didn't, exactly. And that really has informed my attitude since then. I work a lot with documentary filmmakers who come through town, and I do various kind of interviewing. And I always try to make a financial exchange occur because publicity doesn't pay utility bills.
That's a fascinating question because journalists, I mean, that's what you are, basically. Journalists are not really supposed to be trading money to be able to interview people. But you're saying that when you're dealing with this scene, you need to.
Absolutely. And especially people who are not active anymore, but who were active. All these people have is their stories. So it's not like we can say, hey, do this and you'll get a whole bunch of gigs after that. Well, they're not doing gigs anymore.
You know, one thing I find interesting about this whole story about how you came to appreciate the blues in someone like Furry Lewis is you grew up in the era of rock and roll.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the blues were kind of history at this
point. Well, not only rock and roll, but the best rock and roll. I grew up in Memphis where Mudboy and the Neutrons played. You know, they were so good they barely made records. The big one is still coming, and I don't care who you are, I don't care where you are. Listen to the sound of my voice tonight. You might be out there riding along in your automobile. You might be out there somewhere in the suburbs in Babylon. I want you to reach out, put your hand on the radio. I want you to let me know, can you feel it? Can you feel it? That's the cosmic countdown, baby. That's the tick-tock of time, and it's running out. Fair has got nothing to do with it. My book, It Came From Memphis, keeps going back to this player and producer from Memphis named Jim Dickinson. He sort of becomes a through character. And Jim has a saying, let's see if I can get it right. The best songs don't get recorded. The best records don't get released. The best releases don't get played. Something like that, you know? Hmm. And it's sort of, you know,
because by the time they get recorded, corporate America has settled in. I mean, it's sort of, they've been packaged.
Yeah, yeah. And people are looking for the familiar. And so the unfamiliar gets left behind. You know, that's a lot of what Memphis is about, my Memphis, you know, a different way of looking at things. When Elvis walked into Sun's studio and made That's All Right, Mama, they had been recording for hours and not hit their mark. And Elvis was goofing around in front of his two sidemen to keep them inspired. And Sam Phillips was, you know, in the control room and he heard this sound. He said, what are you doing? Come back inside and do that. You know, it's what you were not looking at that is the important thing.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do it, that's all right. That's all right. That's all right, Mama. Any way you do.
Well, now, there's another town in Tennessee that's famous for music, Nashville. What's the difference between Memphis and Nashville?
Again, to quote my friend Jim Dickinson, Memphis and Nashville are just 200 miles away, but they're a world apart. And you can feel it in the drive coming down from Nashville. It's like Tennessee is this big hill, this big tilt, and all the water is sort of washing into Memphis. And there's, when you cross the Tennessee River, I think it's called the Cumberland Plateau, the air changes. I swear to you, you know, you could feel it. If you had your windows down and the air conditioning off, you know, you could feel the air change. And it goes from mountain air to delta air. And the delta is a swamp, you know. Memphis is a swamp.
But you're not just talking about Memphis is blues country and Nashville is country music. Is it more that Nashville is more a company town and Memphis is something else?
It certainly has, yes. But is that because of the air? I mean, Nashville's music industry is built around a life insurance company, right? A life insurance company was the one that sponsored the Grand Ole Opry. Memphis, you know, as a music place, was always where people would get a room in a hotel and go do basically what they called field recordings. They would set up a temporary studio and bring people in to record there. When you walked into Sam Phillips's label, if he was going to record you, he told the guys, whoever he was recording, he said, now I know you think I want to hear what your boss man wants to hear, but I don't want to hear that. I want to hear what you want to play. There was a grit that he was looking for that he wouldn't quit until he got. That applies to Howlin' Wolf as much as it does to Elvis Presley or anybody. There's an emotion in all this stuff that I think ultimately comes down to racial collision in Memphis. everything in Memphis comes down to racial collision, and from that springs this stuff. Now, in other words,
that's what makes the music good, is this collision of the races.
Yes, I think so, absolutely. Collision is sort of that similar idea. It says, look, you know, people are different, cultures are different. We can share a same space, but let's recognize that we're different, that people are different. Kind of jumping here, tangential, but here's my definition of soul music, right? In the 60s, you had white guys who were trying to play black music. You had black guys who were trying to play white music. Well, the sort of country inflection of the white guys prevented them from properly playing the blues. The sort of gospel blues inflection of the black guys prevented them from playing smoothly. That was the 50s. When the children of these guys got together in the 60s, they found they knew the same songs, but they played them differently.
Is that the story of Elvis? That's the common image.
In a way, yeah. But so it's when, what I think is interesting, even more than Elvis, is like the early days of Stax, when black guys and white guys got together and said, okay, hey, look, we know these same songs. We know them differently. And the bridge they built in connecting their two worlds, that's soul music. And that's sort of, in a way, that's Memphis. You know, that's the one side of the coin, and the other is Dr. King being assassinated there. And they're both related.
Robert Gordon's books include It Came from Memphis and Can't Be Satisfied, a biography of Muddy Waters. We talked with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to buy a cassette copy of this program, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for The City as Muse Show, number 229A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Doug Gordon, Mary Lou Finnegan, Veronica Rickert, Ann Strainchamps, and Charles Monroe Kane, with engineering help from Marv Nunn. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, you can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
After World War II, existentialism was all the rage in the U.S. Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus felt that Americans were too self-confident and superficial to accept it. But existentialism has deep American roots. Next week on To the Best of Our Knowledge, the history of angst in America and why Nietzsche's philosophy still matters. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.